This week's parasha is Parashat Vayetze. The parasha begins with Yaakov Avinu leaving Be'er Sheva, leaving is a nice way of putting running for his life, and he goes to Haran in order to find a wife, as it turns out really four, and to build the family, the Shiftei Ka, the tribes of God. The parasha begins with the famous dream that Yaakov Avinu has, where he sees a sulam, a ladder, with angels ascending and descending, and the promise that God will be with Yaakov, and he will multiply into a great nation. The parasha then moves into Yaakov actually reaching Haran, marrying first Leah, the whole deal that was done there, the trickery that was done, and then ultimately he marries Rachel 7 days later after the week of Shavuot Brachot. And he works for them for 14 years, and he gives birth to 11 out of the 12 tribes. Binyamin is born next week's parasha in Eretz Israel. He's the only one of the tribes born in Israel. And the parasha then ends how Yaakov wants his wages from Lavan. And what we'll speak about today is the whole deal of how these wages were actually established. And then the parasha ends with a breach, a covenant between Lavan and Yaakov, and Yaakov flees Lavan's house, that they'll leave at least on peaceful terms. The section I'd like to deal with today is, I think, one could easily argue, the most difficult section in this week's parasha. It's a section known as the spotted and speckled sheep. It makes absolutely no sense to any of us. You know, sometimes we read sections in the Torah which we say, you know, till now I follow and I got the lesson, this is way above me, let me get back down to earth. We almost like can't wait till it's over with. So these sections, I think that's very important that we analyze, we discuss, and try to gain insight for our lives. We'll try. Let's take a look at the section inside. The 30th chapter in Bereishit, where Yaakov Avinu says, you know, I've worked for you for all these years, you know, I'd like some compensation. So what shall I give you? So he answers, do not give me anything. It's a very, very difficult section. We'll try to take at least one approach to it. Just do this one thing for me. I will come back and tend your sheep, giving them the best care. I will go through all your flocks with you today. Remove every lamb that is spotted or streaked. Every sheep that has dark markings. Also remove every goat that is streaked or spotted. It's with that kind that I will be paid. Right? So what he says is, you know, the best type of sheep you can keep. The lower elements of the sheep, the spotted, the speckled, and all these, these are the ones that I'll take as my wages. So what happened? So, number two, Jacob took wands of fresh storax, almond and plain. He peeled white stripes in them by uncovering the white layer under the wands, which is the bark. He set up the wands that he peeled near the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink facing the animals. It was when they came to drink that they usually mated. The animals mated in the presence of the wands, and the young they bore were ring spotted and streaked. So Yaakov Avinu sets up this whole fancy system here. He has a system where while they were drinking the water at the time of mating, they would look at these wands that were, you know, created in a certain fashion. And by looking at them, so when they mated, so the sheep that came forth were spotted, speckled, and streaked and all these types. Very fascinating thing to understand. I'm not even going to begin to explain it. I will say, though, in parentheses, that we learn from here as well from other places that we see the power of thoughts during mating, what effect it has, not only in animals, but in people as well. There's a certain koach, there's a certain power of thoughts that has an impact on the child that one creates. So here, Yaakov Avinu has this whole little plan here wherein he now doesn't have just a couple of spotted speckles and streaks, but he has a large flock, and he's getting larger and larger. At which point, source 3, God said to Yaakov, go back to your birthplace in the land of your fathers, I will be with you. Yaakov sent word and summoned Rachel and Leah to the field where his flock was. I saw your father's face, he said, he's not acting the same with me as he used to, right? Because Yaakov Avinu now is very wealthy. But the God of my father has been with me. You know full well that I served your father with all my strength. Your father swindled me and changed his mind at my pay at least 10 times. I said spotted, so then the sheep were spotted. So no, 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 I said speckled. Then I created speckled sheep. No, 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 I said streaked. And over again, he's changing his mind. Continuing in verse 10, during the breeding season, I suddenly had a vision. I saw the bucks mounting the sheep were wings, spotted and flecked. An angel called to me in God's name, Jacob, and I replied, yes. He said, raise your eyes and you'll see that the buck's mouth and the sheep are winged, spotted, and the fleck. Let this be a sign that I've seen all that Lavan is doing to you. And the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar and made an oath to me, now set out and leave this land, return to the land where you were born. So I'd like to raise a number of questions on this section to try to understand it and try to apply it for ourselves. The first question, which is raised in R.A. Miller's work, Shabbat Shiurim, if it seems strange, second paragraph in 4, that Jacob's main motive for leaving, as he expresses it to his wife, thus seems to be the ingratitude of his father-in-law Lavan, and the miserable and insecure conditions under which he is forced to live. Only at the end of his speech does he mention, you know, by the way, which had been the overpowering motive for his decision, the simple, stark decree of God. The question is the way Yaakov Avinu is presenting it to his wife. He begins off by saying, you know, your father hasn't been treating me the same. And you know, this has been really a difficult time. Business, we haven't communicated so well lately. I'm under a tremendous amount of stress. And then at the end, he says, let's go back home, back to the land of Israel. And oh, by the way, you know, I had an angel of God come to me and say, you know, it's a good idea to go back home. So what should be the real reason he's going back home? How should he begin the conversation? My dear wife, God told me let's go back home. And you know, it really makes sense to me because after all, I'm not doing so well here. It would seem that the main reason of going back home is Lavan, and then a secondary reason seems to be God's request. It becomes even stranger when we know Rachel and Leah's response in Source 5. Have we still have a portion and inheritance in our father's house? Are we not considered as strangers, for we were sold, and indeed he has consumed our money? But all the wealth that God rescued from our father belongs to us and to our children. So now everything that God told you to do, do it. How do they respond? You know, you're right. Things are really difficult in Dad's house. And you know what? God said, let's go back, let's go back. So they respond in the same way. It's just as strange. The response should be, God said, let's go back, so we'll do it unequivocally, we'll go back. And also, we understand that it's not so comfortable here. That's question one. The second question is, why is the Torah spending so much time on how Yaakov has created these spotted and speckled sheep, and the wands, and the sun, and the mating? I mean, there's a whole chapter just on spotted and speckled sheep. Seems strange when every aspect of the Torah has to teach us something. What is this teaching us? What is the message behind this section? What is the message behind the spotted and speckled sheep? So that's our work cut out for us this morning, and indeed it's work. Indeed it's work. And again, as we do every week, we take one approach or multiple approaches. The overall theme that I'd like to deal with today is a theme which is found, I believe, in the first pasuk, the first verse of our portion. Verse number 6, the verse states, Vayetze Yaakov mibe'er sheva, vayelech harana. So Yaakov leaves Be'er Sheva, and he goes to Haran. So the obvious question is, why do we know where he left from? It should just say, he went. Why do I need to know that he left Be'er Sheva? So Rashi on the spot, we all know, is that when a tzaddik, a righteous person, leaves the city, so the city feels it. We know if a great person leaves the city, so their absence is missed. So Vayetze Yaakov mibe'er sheva, Yaakov is really missed in Be'er Sheva. Don't think that he walked away and no one knew it. Another approach, or Moshe Feinstein's Atzal gives in Drash Moshe, and it's the approach I'd like to deal with this morning, is the following. Shelo yachshov ha'adam, one should not think, the underlying section in 6, shirak ha'tachlit nigzar min ha'shamayim, that only the result is decreed and ordained from heaven. Ela sha'av ha'ofen ech la'asik ha'tachlit nigzar. But also, the means and what happens in order to reach this desired goal is also directed from above. It's not only Vayelech Harana that Yaakov Avinu is going to Haran, and that's where you find divine providence. But you also see divine providence, says Rav Moshe Zatzal, in the fact of Vayetze Yaakov mir Be'er Sheva, the leaving of Be'er Sheva, the actual walking, the whole process to reach Haran, also has an inyan, has this aspect of Hashkochas Hashem, divine providence, where he says, Af l'chol psia u'psia, the middle of 6, every footstep, Ma'yitzia ad ba'o l'charan, from leaving until reaching Charan, Shema Hashem mitzadei gaver. God is one who directs the footsteps of mankind. So I think that this establishes for us the theme of Parashat Vayetze, that God is with every individual in every aspect of one's life. Just like to mention, because it hopefully will enhance our daily davening, there's a blessing we say every morning in the Birkos HaShachar, which reflects this idea. We don't even think about it. Usually, the blessing says that we thank God for being Hamechin Mitzadei Gaver, who prepares the footsteps of man. So on a simple level, it's a blessing thanking God for walking. And it's something that we can appreciate. Having a one-year-old tonight, how are you really appreciate the fact of the miracle of trying to walk? Then I guess the novelty wears off. Most of us don't think about getting up in the morning and walking. So we thank God for being Mechin Mitzadei Gaver, of being able to prepare the footsteps of man. But on a deeper level, my prayer, Rabbi Mendel, source number 7, but the blessing is yet a wider and deeper meaning. It reminds us that man's movements, though they are quite free and voluntary, have a deeper purpose connected with divine providence. The steps of man are directed by God, and he delights in his ways. And the he could be referring to uppercase or lowercase, and the his could be uppercase or lowercase. The saintly Baal Shem Tov, who gave us a deeper insight into the meaning of divine providence, explained this passage to mean that while a Jew goes about his business, visits people and places which he thinks necessary for his personal business, there's really a more important spiritual purpose in his moving about from place to place. It may be for the purpose of doing someone else a favor materially or spiritually, or to spread a good influence. Thus, when a Jew realizes that the steps of men are directed by God, he, the man, will delight in God's way, and he, God, will delight in man's way as well. And I think this is an idea that we all know to be true. How often in life we find ourselves in situations that we say, well, what are we doing here? How did we even land here? This is not even where I was planning on being. And somehow or another, a lot of our lives, even though we take the initiative and we do the walking, is very much directed by God, and there are byproducts that we don't even understand of how results come out of meeting people and positive influence that we can have, because God directs our footsteps and he knows we are best we can give in different situations. And that's a blessing we say every morning, but it's really a blessing of Hashkacha, that God is watching our every footstep. Now here comes the obvious question. Let's take a look on the next page. If we try to understand this concept of God being involved in our lives, that God is involved in not only in the outcome, but involved in the process as well. And here's the way Rav Huttner Zatzal explains this idea, and it's so beautiful in Source 9. He says, the philosophers of the world look at the world and try very hard to find room for God in the picture called world. The Jewish view is looking at the world and seeing God and trying to find room for the concept called world. It's two different ways to look at it. You look at the world and you say, well, I got to fit God in somewhere. That's one perspective. Or you look at the world and just see God and say, well, where am I going to fit the concept of world into a realm of all godliness? So if indeed God really is found in the entire world, and everything that happens is from God, and God directs the footsteps of man, so the obvious question that needs to be asked, Source 11, every person's needs are provided for God, and his livelihood comes by a miracle as great as the splitting of the Red Sea. Why did God burden human beings with the yoke of economic endeavor? Why do we need to do anything at all? And this is a famous question, what we call Hishtadlus versus Bitachon. Hishtadlus, putting in our own effort, and Bitachon, having faith in God. If God is taking care of us, okay, let me step back and say, God, I know you love me, you're going to take care of me, so why work? Why do anything? I know you're going to take care of me. You're not going to leave me out in the lurch. And I will say at the outset right now that this question is very deep, very complicated, and we're just going, what we say is raise issues, touch on issues, but clearly in no way, shape, or form, going to answer this major problem in the 7 minutes I'm dedicating to it this morning. Or so. Don't hold me to the time. So the approach of Rav Dessler, Strive for Truth, continuing in 11. Rav Simcha Zissel answered this question by telling us that God laid the burden of endeavor on us as a test. We have been put in a world where Hashem's constant providence is unseen. To all appearances, man himself seems to be in control of all the matters relating to himself, to his business and livelihood. He can easily make the mistake of thinking my strength and the power of my hand have made me all this wealth. But his task is to rouse himself to see, in the midst of this obscurity, that nature has no power and that everything comes from God. No event, large or small, occurs without his decree. And even when he engages in endeavors in the natural sphere, he must be quite sure in his heart that his actions have no compelling power. God will alone is the true cause. And this is very difficult. We live in two worlds. On the one hand, we live in a world where we have to work our utmost and our all. This is called ishtadlus. We have to put in 100% of ourselves. However, even when we put in 100% of ourselves, we need to realize we've done nothing. And this is very hard. That no matter how much I put in, I'm not accomplishing, it's God who's accomplishing. And this is the battle of life. The battle of life is to do our all, to say it's my strength that I'm putting in everything, but at the same moment you need to realize that you've done absolutely nothing. All you've done is put in your all, but God does the rest. And it's very hard. Because by nature we say what? If I've put in my all, then what? I've accomplished. And this is the challenge. Why did God create such a world this way? Wouldn't it have been easier, where things have been so much easier, where we don't need this test? The answer really is that God didn't create such a world this way. Who created such a world? We did. We see it in Surah 13. The basis for this idea is contained in the Torah, where man was told, because you ate of the tree for which I commanded you not to eat, then by the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread. We know that God's punishments are never acts of vengeance, but educational tools with the aim of rectifying the sin. Adam's sin was that he wanted to be acquainted with evil. And this is a whole story in of itself, that he felt that if he could elevate evil, then it'd be a higher level than not having that challenge. In the spiritual state known as Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, only the spiritual has reality. By his sin, he thus excluded himself from Gan Eden and lowered himself to the state called Olam Hazeh, this world, the world of material existence in which nature and matter appear as real. Divine wisdom therefore decided that his remedy was to raise himself once again to see in his heart that nature is an illusion and that God's providence is real. Our working is coming back to the level of Adam before the sin. This he was to do in the midst of working for his living in the world of nature. This is one of the hardest of all tests. It's one of those situations where quote-unquote outer and inner are in conflict. His outer mode of life would conflict utterly with the truth as he was to know it in his heart. His work in the physical world would be, to all appearances, be the pursuit of natural cause and effect, while in his heart he would remain conscious of God's constant providence. In such a situation, there's always a grave danger that the outer action will prevail over the inner intention, and the person will end up as a materialist, a believer in nature for its own sake. We will need to summon up all one's mental and spiritual powers to remain in the world of trust and faith, as we now explain. And this is what I'd like to develop for a little bit while longer. What Rav Simcha Zitzel is saying is the following. We all live a fine line between our outer and inner world. On the outside level, we need to work, we need to believe in ourselves. On the inner level, we believe in nothing of ourselves. That's not me who's accomplishing, it's God who's accomplishing. This runs through a very famous philosophical debate, which is brought on the next page, about does Judaism view working as something which is a commandment of God, or you have no choice, you have to work. It's what we call a bidyavid, it's not what we would want you to do. And this debate, and again, we're just going to touch on it, two representatives of this debate in source 18 is one is the Chova Filavavos, who says a person is commanded by God to go out and earn a living and provide for his family, and at the very same moment have faith in God. Because as the Chova Filavavos says, we all know, and we all know this to be true in our lives, that sometimes we go out and work, And it's not the original intention of profit come from where we thought it would come from, but because we went out and did this project, something from somewhere else completely came around, and that's what gave us the profit. And that happens so often in life, that we're focused on one area, and we assume that our results are going to come from here, and we work and we work and we work, and then out of the blue, we meet a contact, we have this, we have that, and suddenly the profits come from somewhere else. And that's, he says, is why we have to have faith. We can't be so set on ourselves that we're the one who's accomplishing. It's clearly God who's accomplishing. Then there's the other approach of Nachmanides, who says, you know what, our only effort is to believe in God. That's our effort. And Nachmanides is of the approach that really one shouldn't go see a doctor. You have a problem, so the physical ailment is a result of a spiritual defect. Go seek spiritual help. Go to a prophet. Go to a doctor. So he's saying, Nachmanides, that if you're really not on that level to go seek spiritual help, so then okay, then go to a doctor. So it's really two approaches. The approach of the Chovos Levavos of a person sick, according to Chovos Levavos, what would you do? You would call a doctor and pray. It has to work hand in hand. According to the Ramban, if you're not on the level of seeking out God's help, so then go to a doctor. But even according to Nachmanides, who says that this is not what we say, the first rung of approach, he too would hold that one can be involved in the work of effort as long as one understands that if one has a promise from God that everything will be taken care of, at that point you must step back. You must step back. And this, the Ramban explains our section of the spotted and speckled sheep. Says the Ramban in Source 21, that when Yaakov Avinu saw an angel who told him, you know what? I see that lovers have been tricking you. I'll take care of it from now on. At that point, Yaakov steps back. He says, okay. Turns to his wives and said, you know what? Now it's time to leave. So no matter what approach that we take, we see bottom line from the story of Yaakov that you need to have what's called hishtadlus. You need to have effort. Yaakov Avinu, when Laban says, what do you want your wages to be? Doesn't say, God will provide. Doesn't say that. What does he do? Give me the spot in the speckled sheep. And then he goes out and has that whole thing with the sheep and the barks and the wands. And he really goes out and has a hard day's work for years trying to produce and trying to mate and breed these type of sheep. At the moment when the angel comes and says, enough, he steps back and says, enough is enough. Now, so on the simplest level, what the story is teaching us is the importance of hishtadlus, that even though, as we said, the theme of the parsha is hashkacha, that God is involved in our lives, that doesn't mean if God is involved in our lives, then we don't have to be involved in our lives. The story is coming to teach us that no, we need to take our effort, we need to put our effort into our lives and do that which we have to do, but realizing God is ultimately the one in control. And here comes a very interesting question Rav Wolba asked in Al Eshur in Source 23. He says, you know, you run a very fine line. And again, we're just raising issues. Where how does the person ever know when enough effort is enough? And can't one say, well, if God's running the show, I'll just do a minimum amount and God will take care of the rest. Again, very difficult issue. I'd like to take the approach that he takes. Very fascinating approach. He says that all the qualities that a person has, and I'm doing Source 25 now, are qualities that a person needs in order to do the service of God. So that means the intellectual abilities, the talents that a person has, the temperament a person has, the characteristic that a person has. Clearly a person can change them, but the tools that a person are given are the tools from which a person needs to utilize in their lives. And he explains a verse which we all say, it's a very famous Kapitel Tehillim, Mizmor David Hashem Roi, God is my shepherd. In that Kapitel Tehillim there's a verse, and I think it will change our understanding from now on for the rest of our lives. It's brilliant. Verse 26. My soul he restores, Yancheni v'ma'ad le'tzedek, he directs me in paths of righteousness, l'man shmo, for the sake of his name. So explain to Avobo the following. Yancheni b'ma'ag le'tzedek. He leads me b'ma'ag le'tzedek. Ma'agal is literally an igul, a circle. God leads my life in a circle. Which means, we all know that the in basic geometry, that a circle is that all the points are equal to the center. There are no corners in a circle, which means that all aspects of my life, all the talents that I've been given, are in perfect harmony. That's the concept of ma'aglei tzedek, of righteousness, are in perfect harmony for me to achieve that which I need to achieve. One should look at one's life as a circle, as perfect harmony. And that explains nafshi yishovet. My soul, he restores yanchenu ma'aglei tzedek from the fact that my life is a circle, and everything I do, therefore, is l'man shemo, for God's sake. That's who I am. Saying this, he then says on the next page in source 27. Very often you have people who say, well, I tried my hardest, or I did my effort, and now I'm waiting for siyata deshmaya, I'm waiting for help of God. I'm going to let God do the rest. I've done my ishtadlus, and I'm going to let God do the rest. So here he says a very challenging idea. It's an idea which can be best illustrated by the famous story we all know. I'll just repeat it for the sake of my example. The guy who's drowning, and a boat comes by, and the guy says, come on the boat, and we'll get you out of here. He says, no, God will provide. And then, somebody else comes with a rope. And he says, no, God will provide. And finally a helicopter comes down and says, quick, before you drown, grab onto the helicopter. What is the answer? No, God will provide. And what happens? He drowns. He gets up to heaven and says, God, look, here I was a minion. I really believed, and I kept on saying God will provide. And where were you? And what does God respond? Well, who sent the boat? Who sent the rope? Who sent the helicopter? It was me. This is exactly the truth of life. When we talk about Siyata D'Shmaya, when we talk about God's help, you know what the answer is? He does help us. How? Because the Siyata D'Shmaya is within us. The help of God is all the talents and the characteristics and the personalities and the abilities that we have. When a person says, well, I did a little effort, now waiting for God's help, you're missing the boat, literally. What is it? It means that God himself has given us the siyata d'shmaya. He has given us the help of God and found within each and every individual. We need to say to ourselves, have we given our all? Have we put in 100%? Now that we've put in the 100%, we've used, so to speak, the siyata d'shmaya, the help of God from within, so now we can expect and we can look for the siyata d'shmaya from above. So I'll clearly state that when we use this help from within, it's clearly with God's help. It's not that I'm only using my talents and I forget about God. Clearly, it's using my talents with the help of God. That's understood, that this outer and inner level work on every level. And the last point within this idea is he says we need to understand that in life, God really relates to us the way we relate to him, and that the concept of Hashkacha, of divine providence, is very much a shadow of Hashem Tzucha, God is our shadow. And we see this in the beginning of our parasha, when Yaakov Avinu reaches Haran. So the Medrash tells us, it's brought in source 28, the Medrash tells us he reached Haran and he said, oh my, I passed the place where my forefathers prayed on Mount Moriah, and I didn't pray? I missed such an opportunity. At which time there was a Kfitza Saderach, God, so to speak, helped him jump back into the land of Israel in order for him to pray at that place, and that's where he had the dream of the ladder. So the obvious question is, well, God, why don't you stop him while he was walking? Big bright red signs. Stop, place where the forefathers prayed, pray there. They could have done so many things. But the answer is very simple. If you're not going to have this hisorus, this awakening to pray to God, but God's going to let you miss that opportunity. It has to come from within. The desire comes from within. Then you'll have a kvitza saderach, you'll have a jumping of the way that you're going to get back to the land of Israel to pray. What we see here clearly is in this topic, and again we're just touching on it, of Ishtadlus and Bitachon, is that God very much wants for our initiative. He wants us to put in our effort, who we are, into it, but constantly with the realization that as we are involved in the outer world simultaneously, there's an inner world called inner world of self, where I realize it's not me who's running the show, it's God. And God is the one in charge. He's the one who's going to be in charge of the outcome of the product, and that's myself. I think the real question becomes, having just stated this, how do we access this inner world? I don't think we need to talk about here the outer world of how do we have a work ethic. I think all of us know how to have a work ethic, and we all know the strength, and the strength of my hand has done all this. We all feel good about our work, and perhaps we maybe put too much energy in self in our work. I don't think that's the problem. think the greater question is, how do we find Hashkacha? How do you find the hand of God? How do you find that inner world within this world in the fast-paced society that we live in? So that's the question I'd like to focus in on. I think the answer is found, obviously, two answers I'd like to suggest, in the spotted and speckled sheep. I think they provide for us the answer on how to find God. The first approach is found in source 30, Rav Wolb. He says, the question is, how do we find Hashkacha? How do you find the hand of God? How do you find that inner world within this world in the fast-paced society that we live in? So that's the question I'd like to focus in on. I think the answer is found, obviously, two answers I'd like to suggest, in the spotted and speckled sheep. I think they provide for us the answer on how to find God. The first approach is found in source 30, Rav Wolba Aleshur. He says, HaRotzeh Lihitkarev LaHashkacha HaYona. You want to come close to God's providence? Lachyot ima, to live with it, v'lach lehavchin ba, and to really have an understanding of it. Tzarich liyot min hatznuim. You have to be modest. The prerequisite to see hashkacha, to see divine providence, is modesty. Ki hashkacha snuahi. Because the providence itself, by definition, is modest. V'hakadosh baruch hu nikra uman mutzna. God is called a modest artisan. Let's try to explain what this is all about. What do we mean when we say modest? So obviously the first thing that comes to our minds when we think of modesty is what? Hemlines and, length of skirt. That's not what we're talking about modesty. And that's really an outcome of what Jewish modesty is all about. That's what dress is all about. What is Jewish modesty all about? What does it mean that if we are min hatznuim, the ones who are modest, we'll be able to access the modesty of God? And what does this mean? He's uman mutzna, a modest artisan. It's a very challenging description of God. Rabbi Miller in Shabbat Shirim states in 31, answering our original question, why did Yaakov as well as Rachel and Leah seem to make the reason why they're leaving because of the inhospitable circumstances of Laban's house rather than the reason, which is a real reason, that God commanded? So this is what he answers based on the writings of Rabbi Dessler. Rabbi Dessler explains that, in fact, it was, of course, only the will of God that determined their decision, and no other consideration would have affected it. It was, however, a kind of moral modesty and integrity that caused them to state clearly their secondary motives for leaving, the insecurity and ease of life with Lavan, to acknowledge the human element in their decision. Since this element was indeed present, they wish not to seem to hide it, not to pretend to live on a completely superhuman level. It is this perfect scrupulousness that is demanded of man so that he will see clearly what stage of his moral progress he has reached and not assume his motives to be pure than in fact they are. Modesty means being honest about where you are and not trying to flaunt or to pretend to be on a level you're not. Yes, there was a consideration that God said. That's a very high, lofty reason. I'm going to pick up and leave everything. The challenge of Lech Lecha. But you know what? There was a very practical reason. They were uncomfortable in Laban's house. By stating that as their primary reason, they're being in touch with called being human, knowing themselves. He continues about this quality of modesty to try to develop this idea. He says the quality known as tzniut modesty is thus seen to be capable of the utmost refinement. Of the Torah and service of God in general, we are told the verse we spoke about last week is very close to you in your mouth, in your heart, to do it. It is on these three levels that the service of God is carried out, in speech, in thought, and in action. And with particular reference to this quality of modesty, we can also trace the threefold thread of thought. We have modesty in speech, the famous Medrash, how Rachel, by keeping the verse 33, as reward for the modesty shown by Rachel when she handed over to her sister the signs of recognition on her wedding night, she became the ancestor of Saul, and as reward for the modesty shown by Shaul when he kept silent about the fact he'd been chosen to be king, he became the ancestor of Esther, who kept silent about her origin. Modesty in speech means not saying everything you know. Keeping some of the things, or a lot of the things, to yourself, not flaunting that which you have. There's also modesty of thought, which is based on the verse in Micha, to walk modestly with God, which the Aramaic translation says, be modest in the fear of God. There's a requiring reticence in the performance of the mitzvot. What does this all mean in thought, in deed, in speech? So here I think a sense of what this means is found in 35. Rav Simcha Zissel explains the following. He says, a very precious possession is not used often and for every mundane purpose. It is reserved for rare and significant occasions so that it may not be spoiled in any way. And we all have that. There's some fine set of china that we only take out when? The finest occasion. There's jewelry we have in a safe somewhere in a bank that we take out only for what? For the finest occasion. Because if by using it all the time so you lose its preciousness, you lose its specialness. Similarly, in the higher reaches of devotion and perfection, the fear of God is a very precious thing and should not be called upon at every trifling opportunity. Where possible, one should try to act and speak in a straightforward way without drawing on this precious reserve of holiness, and certainly not to display it before the eyes of others, leading them to an exaggerated opinion of one's moral stature. It's an essential condition for the preservation of this holiness that is cherished in quietness and seclusion, not exploited or brandished. It's an inner wealth that is only damaged by being exposed to the external of speech and action. There's a part of us with our relationship with God, this is what we're speaking about, of tsanua. We're in, it's that closeness to God where you don't want to flaunt to everybody. Through your actions, through your speech, through your deeds, because by doing that you lose its preciousness, you lose its connection. And that's why we see then that even in matters of devotion to God, a certain reticence is desired, a guarding of inner purity from exposure. This would lead to a refined form of deception in the very fact that are meant to express an overwhelming inner dedication. And this was the motive of Jacob and his wives. They hesitated to display even in a subtle way their utter submission to the will of God. Any shadow of a secondary consideration would have rendered such a display of deception. Rather than that, they spoke in the normal language of men. Clearly, God played a part, but they're not trying to deceive anyone or themselves by saying they're on a level that they're really not. They're working within the realm of nature. And he says in conclusion of this part in 39, the general principle that emerges is that in a large degree the external is the enemy of the internal. Any virtue won through diligent and self-denying effort faces its gravest danger when it's displayed to the public gaze. The danger of pride that vitiates every single spiritual gain. Even the virtue of humility, ironically enough, is not immune from this fatal self-consciousness. It is even possible to be proud of one's humility. In guarding against even the slightest taint of this most harmful of vices, the precautions of modesty have a highly practical value. Which means that if you've worked on a relationship with God, you've worked on a closeness, then you keep it inside. You keep it as something precious and not something you flaunt outward. The last point Rabbi Miller makes, and that will connect with God as being this uman who is sanua, is that in 37, Rabbi Dessler writes that righteous men always fear that the miracles that God performed for their sakes would kindle pride in them. They tried, therefore, to do whatever they could in a natural way so to cover up the miraculousness of God's intervention. Righteous people, when they have this close relationship with God and miracles are performed, they always try to do it in the most natural way possible so that one shouldn't think that a miracle is going on and create this level, which is really perhaps a level that they're not on. The example that he brings is that of Elisha, who resurrects this boy. When I teach this to my students, the way that Navi describes it, he puts his face on his face, his mouth on his mouth, his nose on his nose, the kids jump up, CPR, immediately. Great, that's exactly what the Navi wants us to see. This boy is no longer alive. It's not CPR. I mean, it's really resurrection of the dead. But why does the Navi want that seventh graders to jump up and say CPR? That's the exact reason, that it should look as a natural way. And this, continuing 37, this he did by way of veiling to some extent the clarity of the miracle. And this even though he was alone in the room. There was no one before whom he he hesitated to reveal his greatness. Even in his own presence, that is, he preserved a certain modesty. And that's the greatness. Who was he hiding this miracle from? Himself. Himself. That's the beauty. The beauty is when you're between you and yourself, you're modest. And you keep that special part of yourself intact. Which explains also the beginning of our parasha. When Yaakov Avinu lies down to go to sleep, he takes some of the stones of the place. And Rashi tells us, why is he taking stones of the place? I'm summarizing 38, because he's afraid of the wild beasts that were going to come. And this way he's going to protect himself. Rip outside, let's get real. Lion's going to come out. Ooh, I see three stones around this person's head. I'm not going to attack them. Please, give me a break. Is the little stone's going to stop an animal from attacking? No. That's the whole point. The point is that the stones were just almost a concealment to try to work within the natural way as much as possible, because ultimately one understands that it's God who's the one who's protecting them, but yet one works through the natural means so as not, as we see it with the asterisks in 38, the circle of stones with a token gesture to blunt the full impact of the miracle that God was performing for his sake, to maintain this level of sneus, this level of modesty. And this we see in sources 40 to 40 and 41, what God himself does. When God performs miracles, he always tries to perform miracles in the most natural way possible, concealing his essence. We find this, for example, when he split the Red Sea. The verse says, and a wind came and blew the sea into two parts. It says, well, but if you really believe that a little wind can blow a massive sea into two parts, and have them stand, one wall here, one wall there, then I have a bridge to sell you, basically. I mean, not giving me a break. But what's the point? The point is that we have a natural way of describing a miraculous so that we conceal the miraculous. This is the idea of sneer. It exists. There are levels that within us exist, but we're not flaunting them on the outside. We're keeping them concealed. Second example is that there was always a fire on the Mizbeach, on the altar from God. But yet God tells us every morning, put wood on the fire. Well, if it's a fire from God, who needs to put wood on the fire? God's going to put the wood on the fire. The same idea, that we try to give it as much of a natural occurrence as possible, but yet we have to understand beyond that, that there is miraculous going on. And this, says Rav Wolba, is why tzniut, modesty, is a prerequisite to see God in our lives. He says, and this is source 42, Lirot hadarim ba'omkam, to see things on their deepest level, to live in a world of olam tzniut. That's what tzniut really means, to live in an inner world, an untouchable world. If you're able to see things on the deepest level, listakel mib'ad tofaot, and to see beyond what's going on, but to realize there's a lot more that's hidden, that's concealed. Rak b'mabat zeh yecholim lavchin et archei hashkacha mistarim acharei ha'tofa atzma. If you live in that world where you in your own life concealed a lot more than which is visible to the public, then you'll be able to see that which God conceals and be able to live in that inner world which is concealed in the outer world that we live in. And that's why he says God is called Yoshe B'Seter Elyon, B'Tzel Shakai Yidlonan, God is hidden, God is concealed. So the first prerequisite of seeing God is to be able to live a world of being sensitive to the concept of modesty. To live a life where you're going to be realistic about who you are and not flaunt it, and to be able to keep within the true essence of self. If you in your own life see that there's a lot more in you than you're showing outward, so then you'll be able to see in the world around you there's a lot more of godliness than is being shown outward as well. If you're able to go beyond within, you're able to go beyond without in God's world and be able to see the hand of God, the hashkacha, and everything that happens. That's level number one. Level number two. How do we see the divine hand in our lives? So here, I think the answer lies not in the conversation of Yaakov and Lavan, or Yaakov and his wives, but rather in the sheep themselves. Just make note in source 43, the Nesiva Shalom points out that this story of the spotted and speckled sheep contains all the deepest secrets of Torah. You want to know all the deep secrets of Torah? Learn this section of the spotted and speckled sheep. Since I'm not on a level of deep secrets of Torah, let's turn to the next page. And let's at least see one level of what these sheep teaches us, so that when we do read it in the Torah, something meaningful will come out. So explained to the Nesiva Shalom, which is a Hasidic approach, he said of all the midos, of all the characters that a person has, there's one that one needs to use at all times, at all places, and that is the mida, the attribute of emuna, of faith in God. That is something which is for all times and places. And he says that the different types of speckled and spotted sheep represent different types of emuna, different types of faith. The first is, and this is the bottom, second bottom line in source 44, Zemirumaz v'tevad akudim, shehum lashon akud bekel chai. Akudim, sheep, from the word akedah, to be bound, like the akedah sitcha, the binding of Isaac. The sheep that had these rings on them, this is the level of being bound to God, intellectually being connected to God. The next level of sheep are called nikudim, which is nirumaz l'nikudat halev. A nikud is a spot. Nikudat halev is a spot in our heart. Haynu shemuna tishkon gam balev. Shegam b'nikudat halev yarkishat emuna. A higher level is not to just know God intellectually, but to know God emotionally. The nikudim, the spot, is to move God into the spot in your heart. And it's not so easy. I know I just recently asked one of the classes that I teach, how many of you feel an emotional connection to your Judaism? An emotional connection to your Judaism. It's a very challenging question to think about. Because intellectually you ask people, do you believe so? A lot of people say, whatever level I'm on, I believe. But now you ask them, do you emotionally believe? That's a very challenging question. That's a nikudim, that's a second level. And then there's even a higher level. And that's the brudim, the other level of the speckled sheep. And that is referring to the limbs of the body. That's not only intellectually you believe and emotionally you believe, but in all of your actions and all that you do, you believe. That when I give charity, I really know that I'm not losing the $100 that I'm giving. That I believe this is the right thing to do. It goes beyond the intellectual, beyond the emotional, into who I am as a whole being. Now this is what I'd like to end with today, because it's very, very important for where we are at in life. Emuna, faith, has to be the cornerstone of life at all times. I'd like to work through, in the time that we have remaining, this book that I can't but highly recommend, Jeremy Kagan's book, The Jewish Self. Almost like still a recording record here. I've mentioned that three times. It's a very difficult book, a very deep philosophical book, The Jewish Self, by Jeremy Kagan. So at the end of this book, and again, I'm really being unfair that I'm presenting parts without seeing a total whole. That's why I'm recommending reading the book. He says the following. Source 46. Faith, the recognition of the existence and involvement of the transcendent in the world, is the direct complement to the awareness of a spiritual aspect within ourselves. We necessarily have no direct access to the existential quality of being in the world around us, since we perceive the world only through our physical senses. Each of us knows only one object in its essence, and that is ourselves. We can know the inner reality of existence only by extrapolation from our inner experience. If we find ourselves empty within, then we will see an empty world. But if we experience an inner depth which transcends our physical awareness of self, and we spoke about this at length last week, of working through one's character traits to see that concept of godliness, then we must extrapolate that depth to the outer world in the form of faith. So by looking within, we can extrapolate without and have a relationship with God. Faith cannot genuinely exist without this level of self-awareness. This quality of inner depth is utterly lacking in the Roman society of which we are part, the Western civilization. We are empty inside, and we all can vouch for that. The society we live in is a society of a vacuum. And therefore see no greatness in the world around us. And that's why we have no natural, genuine faith. 47, faith is a reality of connection to the Creator. The feeling we normally associate with the term faith is merely an experiential consequence of that connection. In the past, when we were defined by our spiritual aspect issuing directly from the Creator, the connection came through that spiritual self. But now we are firmly anchored in our detached bodies and finite egos. How can we connect to the infinite? In times gone by, when there was a temple, when there was prophecy, when you really felt the divine presence in the world, so very easy to feel God, because you looked through self and you saw clearly the divine within self. If you saw the divine within self, so you saw God. We live in a detached world where we don't connect with God. We really separate ourselves to a tremendous degree. And that's why that question, do we feel emotionally connected to God in our Judaism, is a very, very difficult question, because we have this detachment. So how do we connect if we're unconnected? And this is the key. 48. Can't miss the punchline. Nature provides a model for how two things that do not touch can nevertheless be joined. A violin at rest will resonate on its own when a cello plays the exact note to which the violin is tuned. The violin receives and expresses the cello's energy because the violin resembles the cello. They attach harmonically because they are tuned to the same note. Similarly, we can join ourselves to the Creator by resembling Him. If we are properly tuned, we can connect. Let's explain. 50. The most fundamental characteristic of the Creator is His necessity. We emulate necessity when who we are is not dependent on something outside of ourselves, but rather is an expression of our capacity to choose, which is our essential self. Then we grow out of our essence. The more profoundly who we are is the result of our choice, the more profoundly we imitate the Creator and thereby cleave to Him. It is within this context we must now understand our confrontation with Rome. Rome utterly negates real connection to the Creator and lends no support whatsoever to the most fundamental choice we face in our lives, the choice of faith. Rome attacks our very essence, our connection to transcendence, and leaves us no alternative but to create ourselves out of our own ashes. But precisely because Rome cuts so deep, we can succeed. By forcing us to create our own foundation, it allows us to achieve faith. For only in the unassisted choice do we emulate the Creator and achieve the harmonic resonance, which is the basis of connection in the modern world. And that's why he says this is a very challenging idea in 52. Because the vision lent us by the dominant society of our day utterly negates faith, we must undertake a methodical reconstruction of our entire vision of reality and self, premised upon our relationship with the Creator. Today, faith is not an experience, it's an act. In the past, you looked into yourself and you felt yourself, you felt your connection to God, it was an experience. Today, since we don't have that connection, we need to act in the most divine way. Freedom of choice, of building self, of building this relationship, and in so doing, resonate with God. Through our striving for faith, we create ourselves, and through creating ourselves, we attain faith. Clearly, an achievement of faith cannot exist in a vacuum. It must have a direction. There's no such thing as spirituality without obligations. Such a concept is eternally contradictory. If transcendent being is real, it founds our existence. If it founds our existence, then it obligates. If we recognize the depth within us and do not accept the obligation to give it physical expression, we deny its necessity. If this spiritual aspect is not compelled, it is not the necessary being which is the source of meaning and reality. It's an intellectual construct. It's an idea which entertains us, not a reality which founds us. And I think that this is really what the sheep is saying to us, and what Yaakov did with his sheep. Faith is something, what Yaakov was doing with manipulating the sheep that it should be spotted, speckled, and the sun and the mating, is really a model for us. That at this time that we live in, faith does not happen automatically. Faith has to be created. The model of Yaakov is the model of the Jew in Gullus, the Jew in exile, the Jew in loved one's house. It's the Jew that has to create faith. It's the Jew that has to create the spotted and speckled sheep. It has to be the Jew that creates faith intellectually, emotionally, and through everything we do. And that can only be done by recognizing that there is this barrier between us and God, that we don't feel this essential self of connectedness to God, that we need, like the cello and the violin, to resonate in our own lives to emulate God. We spoke about last week through our characteristics emulating God, through the keeping of the Torah emulating God by creating free, positive choices, emulating God, and in so doing, what we are doing is creating this opportunity of faith of this relationship with God. I think this is on the deepest level is what the concept of Hashkocha, the concept of divine providence, is all about. Yes, divine providence is here, but what does Hishtadlus mean? On the deepest level, it's not only that we have to work, we have to give it our all. What it really means is that we are creating our relationship with God. And the way to see the Hashkocha is to work on this understanding that we need to have a relationship with God. The more we work on this relationship with God, the more we are creating this connection with God, this resonance as the cello to the violin. Let's just summarize what we've seen for today. It's a lot of different ideas in one shiur. What I'm trying to argue today is that the theme of one of the themes of this parasha is the concept, the parasha begins as Hashkocha, divine providence, where God watches every step of the way, not only the result. Where does that leave us if God is in control of everything? It leaves us in us taking initiative. We must, as the Chovos Halevavos says, we must go out and work, we must earn a living. Even the Ramban would say, one can do that unless one has a specific promise from God. We need to take the initiative in our lives, but understanding that that's just the outer world. There's an inner world, and this is the test we're in. This is the challenge. This has happened as a result of the eating of the fruit. There's an inner world which says that we need to be cognizant that it's not us who's accomplishing, it's God who's accomplishing. We give 100% of what God has given us, and Cheni B'Magle Tzedek, the circle of our lives, with the help of God, but understanding that our real efforts are only going to be in God's hands. How do we live a life that we're cognizant of the divine in our lives, that we don't lose the perspective, we don't lose the forest from the trees? So I'm trying to present today is two philosophical constructs. One being the ability to be a tzanua, to be a modest person, focusing in on self, realizing that God is someone who also conceals himself. If we're sensitive to the concept of concealment, we too will see God concealed. And that's why the way Yaakov speaks and Rachel and Leah speak, of trying to speak on human terms where they were at and not trying to be on a level they were not at. And the second level, perhaps, is the level of the sheep themselves. I mean, it's a level of emuna, a level of faith. But it's what Yaakov does to breed these sheep in this fashion. It's that we need, in our society that we live in, the model of the gullus of exile, we need to create this faith by emulating God, by realizing that there is this lack of connection and working on trying to connect the two. And that's what Hishtadlus, that's what effort is all about in our understanding of Bitachon, of our faith for God.